There was once an unhappy world. I'll give you a minute to think about it. And in this unhappy world, there were lots and lots of unhappy people. And they were unhappy because no matter what they did, no matter how hard they tried, and so many tried so hard, and so many succeeded even at obtaining the ideal of what it was that they thought would make their life content and complete. Even those, they were touchy. And worse than touchy, they were afraid, because once they had won what they thought would make them free, then they had to guard it. And so instead of being set free by the things that they believed would free them, they became the slaves of the very things they thought would give them that liberty. And so you had a place filled with human beings, none of who really liked their life, but all of who thought that tomorrow would be a better day, that somehow that which they had imagined that didn't complete them in the yesterday, that tomorrow it would change magically. But of course, this went on for so many thousands of years, and so much happened, so much hatred took place, because the more people tried to get what they thought would make them happy, the more afraid they were they would lose it. And the more afraid they were lose it, the more ways in which they invented to keep it, until finally you had a race of beings, everyone looking at everyone else as either suspect or prospect. I'll give you a minute. Yes or no? Suspect or prospect? Does he fit into my life? Will he make it better? Can he give me something to bring me more freedom? Or does he just look like that and I'm going to regret it later? How many of you know that story, ladies? Men too. All day long on this planet, in our story, people continued to try to change themselves by seeking answers to their problems within the very nature that had produced the world they were in. And it didn't matter what they pulled out of the hat of their head, because whatever it was, they had visited that rabbit so many times before that it was just a different color, a different set of ears, a different coat, but basically the same rabbit. And then a young man who lived in this world, without really understanding why, he knew that the world wasn't as it should be. And I might add, just as every one of us listening to this know that the world isn't as it should be. Every one of us. And in this story, because it's necessary to point it out, it was a bit of a miracle that he knew there was something wrong, because when you live with a race of beings, all of whom have agreed to pretend that what's wrong could be right one day, then you have a planet filled with people who merely postpone the inevitable, which is running into their own creation over and over and over again, and then denying their own creation, blaming the people and the positions they have, everything around them, for the reason that the things that they have don't satisfy them, or that they lose and then have to gain again. And this young man thought to himself, I know in my heart of hearts, and I don't know why. And that's going to be a big thing tonight. We're going to hear that, and I don't know why, a number of times. And I don't know why I know it. But I know I'm not supposed to be someone who says cruel things to other people out of fear of what they may or may not do for me. I know I'm not supposed to speak cruelly to people. I know that I'm not supposed to take advantage of other human beings. I know I'm not supposed to take advantage of other human beings. I tell myself I do it because if I do it now, I'll get enough and then I won't have to do it later. But I know that that later never comes. I know that I mustn't be that kind of human being. I know that I should put other people what they need at the moment of their need. I know I should put it before myself, but I'm so selfish. And he kept thinking about the way in which the world was, his role in it, and how the world ought not be that way. Not condemning himself. Please don't misunderstand me, and don't misunderstand the tone of the talk. There isn't one human being on the planet who doesn't do the best that he or she knows to do in the moment. Not one of us doesn't do the best we know. The question is there something better we can do? That's the question. Because if we can ask the question with great honesty, taking into account our own nature and all of the effects that this nature has had, personally and planetary, and recognize the outcome of what we are and what we've done and the things that we value, then there's a chance that something can change, but not if we lie to ourselves, which is what this planet in my story had become a master of doing, was lying. Whatever it was, it may not be quite right, but we'll learn the lesson in this, and when we learn the lesson, then we won't do it again, and then everything will be great. And that went on for 430,000 years. Just as it's gone here, 400 whatever number of years it is that human beings in whatever form have walked the earth. And he thought to himself, what if this longing I have to be a different kind of human being belongs to a world in which other human beings like myself have longed to know, to be in? What if there is actually a place? And now I have to break into my own story, because I'm going to use symbols and metaphors to describe what will seem to be other places, other times, and all the rest of that. But in the end, I'm not talking about a world apart from this world. I'm talking about a world that this world resides within. Have you ever heard the expression, in my Father's kingdom there are many mansions? I'm talking about the beginning of an understanding of a relationship to a world that holds our world. And that in the world that holds our world, because it is more integrated, that which is above is always more integrated than that which is below. It is a law, a spiritual law, as well as a natural law. And that world that sits above the world that we live in, which is in, within each and every one of us, this young man wondered if there wasn't such a world where he was able to be, now I'll change the subject a little bit, be in command of himself the way he wanted to be in command of himself. And what does it mean to be in command of ourselves? Does it mean to be able to walk into a restaurant or a place where people are having a fine meal and carry ourselves across the restaurant as though it were something special and we know that people are looking at us and we're in command of our appearance? Listen, please. Did you know that if you're concerned with an appearance, you're not in command of anything? Fear is in command of you projecting the appearance so that you can have the sense of security that seems to come from the image. To be in command of oneself means, amongst other things, that at the moment that you see something happen, maybe somebody drops a piece of paper on the floor, you walk over and you pick up the piece of paper. You didn't drop it. To be in command of yourself is to recognize there's a natural order and it doesn't include dirt on the floor, and you're not above picking up something that someone else has dropped. But the command that we call ourselves having is the command of wanting to make enough money to hire someone to follow around and pick stuff up for us. Isn't that the truth? Please do yourself a big favor. Take a deep breath. Some of you look like you're going to pop already. I haven't even started. It's okay. It's okay. You say it, actually. It's okay. It's okay. I'm a wreck. It's okay. I am. Look at I've been pretending so long. I don't know where the pretense begins and ends, and I'm a wreck, and I don't want to be that anymore. I don't want to hurt people anymore with the tension that's produced by trying to act out something that I've never pulled off in the first place. Do you know that? Do you know that everybody knows you haven't pulled it off? Only you don't know that. Come on, look around. How many of you know everybody is like this giant phony baloney, and you're the only person who thinks you're not? Thank God I'm amongst friends. I'm serious. If we can start to laugh, we have more than half the battle won. If you want to know what makes a person so serious that their face looks like a balloon that's just about to pop, it's because they believe in themselves. They believe that their ideas about themselves is the same thing as having a self in command of itself. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice to be able to, speaking of being in command of yourself, to be able to meet someone and prior to you meeting them, walking into a room like this filled with 100 and some odd people, and you walk by somebody, and rather than looking at them and trying to figure out who and what they are, you just meet them. Then you're fresh and they're fresh. And even if they're not fresh, it doesn't matter to you, because you have been in command of the parts of yourself that are forever judging everyone and everything that it sees. So back to our story. The young man heard that in a distant part of the country, there was reputed to be a bridge. A bridge that went from the world that he was in to the world that he had heard about, where human beings didn't hurt one another, and where basically human beings fulfilled the purpose of their existence, not through trying to prove themselves, but in an endless series of discoveries of their true and authentic role in creation itself. And he liked the idea of it. He liked the idea of participating in life instead of having to prove himself all the time. He liked the idea of having the purpose of his life fulfilled moment to moment by the very act of his own awareness in his own nature, instead of something where we have to set out and prove ourselves, gain it, and then show it to people as though it means something. Do you know that if you have to show someone what you have to give yourself a sense of self, do you understand that you haven't gained anything? Most of us don't understand that the pursuit of possessions as we presently do them, and mark this, I am not saying that we should not excel in business. I am not saying that we should not excel in our science, in our craft. I'm saying that there should be the first excellence and then all other excellences that follow. And the first excellence always has to do with being a human being who is in command of himself or herself, because that human being is in relationship with what gives that individual command, which we're going to get to, and gives that individual what would be a fearless life. I want you to understand that a fearless life does exist. But I want you to understand that this fearless life that exists is not without fear in it. We have ideas about what it means to achieve certain states spiritually, physically, psychologically. And it never really dawns on us that for all of the ways in which we achieve these states in our mind, that the time comes when we need them. How many have ever gone and learned something about, you know, how you should be, or you gain some spiritual practice or something like that? And then when the rubber hits the road, you can't find anything even like what you need to stay in command of yourself. Yes or no? Raise your hands. Every one of you, raise your hands. See, the point is, what's the point? What is the point of that? Of acquiring one idea, one set of beliefs, one image, one way in which, for this moment at least, I'm pretty sure who I am. And then the more you go through life, and all of us can attest to this, because I know this is a room of aspirants, people listening to this, by God, you wind up with so many things that you know, that the moment comes where you need to act on what you know, and you have a heart attack just trying to find who you should be. Is this the right me? Because I'll know it's the right me if you look like it's the right me. But if you don't think it's the right me, I'll change me for you. Isn't that true? Yes, it is true. He didn't want to live like that. And so he set out to find this bridge. He set out to find a way in which to cross to a world in which fear was not what it was in the world that he was in, but actually served in a purpose and a principle within himself to further his own understanding, which I will explain in another story after this story. He reached a place, and when he got there, he was pretty sure he'd reached the place where the bridge was. And by the way, so that you know, an actual bridge exists. An actual bridge exists. It isn't in space and it isn't in time. It's not connected to an idea. There is no path to it, no path that one takes from it, but a bridge exists. And he got there, but in the story, I have to use illustrations. He got there, and there were 10,000 people. 10,000 people all kind of camped around the edge of what, when he walked up to, he saw there was a cliff. And I'm not talking just a little cliff. Have you ever seen those movies where you look down and it goes down for like until you can't see where it goes down to? And he walked over and try to picture this. It's important for the story. There was a stepping stone about 2 feet out from the bridge, just suspended there in air, with a couple little lines that went to what looked like another stepping stone, but he couldn't tell because there was a great bank of fog right on the edge of the second step. So here's what he could see. He could see what looked like a bottomless pit. He could see a stone kind of floating over the bottomless pit 2 feet out, and it seemed to be attached to something else, and that's all there was. So he started walking around, and he said to them, "Is this the bridge? Is this the bridge to fearlessness? Is this the bridge to the new land where beings are different than they are?" And everybody said, "Yes." "Oh, thank God," he said. "Yes, come to our meeting tomorrow. Come to our meeting tomorrow because we need to tell you before someone else tells you there are those that believe that isn't the bridge. And they'll try to convince you that that isn't the bridge, but you come and stay with us and we'll show you that's the bridge." And he said, "Well, how can I be sure?" Now, please listen. This is where we have to bring ourselves into this. How can I be sure that's the bridge? And they said, "Do you doubt our word? We have books. We have masters. We have masters of the bridge. Come to the meeting tomorrow and you'll learn everything you need to know about the bridge." And to make a long story short, because I have another story to tell you, he said simply this. He said, "Well, how do you know it's the bridge? Have you walked across it?" And the person that he was speaking to, which represents this basic level of human consciousness, "Well, we're not sure it'll hold. Give it a minute. We're not sure it'll hold. We think it will. And we have several groups who are all studying this. We have scholars of the bridge. We have people who can attest to what's on the other side. Have they been there? No, but..." And then he did something that this whole talk is predicated on. He went and he took his right foot and he stood on the first step. And when I tell you that he stood on the first step, I'm not telling you the terror that went through his heart as he stepped out upon it, because only the individual who actually tests the truth knows whether or not the truth will hold and leads to another world. Only the human being who tests it. Now, this is where it gets tough for all of us. So I'm going to tell you the second story, and then I'll finish it up with the third story. You'll get it immediately. Second story. There was once a father, and he had two sons, and the father owned a great piece of property. And he said to his two sons, in essence, "I'm going to give you equal parts of this land in order for you to build your homes and grow your food and establish your homes, your family. And it is my great happiness to give you this so that you may for yourself make something of this land." Translated, God gives us this life. And he says to us, basically, "What will you make of this life?" Basically. And if you don't like God, that's okay. If you don't like the word God, it makes no difference. Life gives you this life and says, "What will you make of this? What will you do with this parcel called your heart, with this parcel of mind that you're given that can be in relationship with the world that fulfills itself endlessly? What will you do?" And so the two boys said, "Thank you very much. That's fantastic." And they set out. Several months later, at a family gathering, the eldest of the two brothers comes to his father and says, "Hey," I know that's funny to me, "Hey, hey, Dad," and if you're a parent, you'll understand this immediately, "Hey, Dad, I heard you were out on my brother's property last week helping him sow seed. Do you think that's really fair? And Dad says, well, son, what exactly do you mean by that?
What do I mean?
How come you helped him and you didn't help me? And his father says, well, son, isn't it obvious?
No.
Well, you see, son, he actually started clearing the field and planting it.
So?
Son, all you've ever done is talk about getting started. I'll say it again. Son, all you ever have done is talk about getting started. You've heard that saying, God helps those that help themselves. The real meaning behind it is that there is an ineffable, an absolutely subtle but unmistakable power that exists to give any human being who is willing to receive it a share of a kind of understanding that makes it possible every day in 10,000 ways, and I'm going to cover a number of them, to step out, to get started. Look, I look around, and believe me when I tell you, I've been talking for a long, long time to men and women. We're so sated with spiritual knowledge. We've all read books. We've been slapped on the head with peacock feathers and bowed our heads and touched shoes and been to different parts of the world, know how to make carrot souffle or whatever it is that a person identifies as being something spiritual. But the fact is, and this is what we have to be honest about, we're still ravening. We're still upset if someone doesn't like the way we say what we say. We'll do things all the time that compromise ourselves for the sake of keeping peace with people that we don't even want to be around. Yes or no?
Yes.
So what I'm talking about now when I say, son, you haven't even got started, I'm saying that there is a point at which, for those of who, for whom this is true, and may God make it so for all of us, that our life, moment to moment to moment, relationship by relationship, instant by instant, has to be that point at which we recognize that there is a bridge and we need to step on it, meaning there is a truth. Let me get this point out. There is a truth. And I'm telling you, there is a truth. I could say to you, there is a God. But to say there is a God, and then to find out whether or not there is a God that you can rely on. And I'm not talking about somebody sitting someplace on a planet, you know, on that, in the world where the bridge was. They had all kinds of things. People wore bridges around their neck, and they prayed to the bridges because that made them actually someone who thought they had something. This is not what I'm speaking about. I'm speaking about the actual relationship that is born when a person in their day-to-day life steps out into the moment in which the only thing that they can truly rely on is whether or not truth will give them something to hold them up in the moment, and in holding them, take them one step further in the understanding that God exists, that a truth exists that will sustain them. And that's where the command comes from. Human beings have no command of their own. The only command human beings have is phony baloney command, period. You find somebody that got great command, his command is predicated upon a position he's earned. And if a command is predicated on position or power or authority granted by the world, the minute the world changes, that position changes, the power disappears, and he's reduced to what he always was, which was an actor pretending to have command. Yes or no? Because we've all been there. See, this is what's so fantastic. We're one thing. If you can see it, we're actually one thing. We're one mind, one heart, one being. That's a fact. But presently, this being is divided into two camps, so to speak. Those who are actually willing to take out and step to find out whether there actually is an intelligence that is fearless because it can transform whatever takes place into something higher, or what most of us have been, someone who talks about that. We've become master seminar attendees. Yeah. Okay, next story. Take a deep breath. Now, I have to say it before I tell you this story, because it's kind of fun. We can relax a little bit now. That there's dialogue in this story, and if I can do it properly, there's actually kind of, we're in the Wild West during this. So keep in mind that the story has a dialogue, and that I'll probably blow while I'm doing it, but that the end of the story, meaning the point of the whole story, is something that after I give it to you, hopefully you'll receive it directly, but then I'm going to explain to you what I mean by that and how it all ties together with this idea of finding out whether there is indeed a divine intelligence, a true intelligence that cannot betray itself and that is infinitely connected to itself in a way that any human being finding it begins to live a different order of being. Story. This is someplace in the Wild West, in a small town, and we've all seen enough Westerns and read books, you know, the dirt that's always in the dust in the air, and the wood walkways, the small shops, the sundry, the guy banging out the iron with a blacksmith, just classic Western town. And our hero in this classic Western town, which up to the point that I'm bringing you into the story, wasn't a bad little place. I mean, human beings were as human beings are and always have been, but all in all, there wasn't a lot of disharmony there. My mind just said, until the sheep herders came. I don't know why it said that. And there's no sheep in this story. Oh, dear. And then one day, our hero, who his name is, we'll name him David, he was the sheriff of this town. It was laconic. There wasn't a lot going on there. It wasn't a lot to be sheriffing, which is why he was happy to be sheriff, because his nature was not one of, you know, let me straighten you out kind of nature. He had a real heart, as you'll see. And then one day, in the distance, I love adding sound effects. In the distance came on six horses the Darkly brothers. Yeah, go. You know what? That's good. Sound effects. Exactly. That's exactly it. The Darkly brothers. They were bad. Really bad. How bad were they? Really bad. And they immediately began to sow all kinds of fear into the people in the town. Now, continue, if you will, to understand that every story that I'm telling, the town, the people, the villains, and the heroes, every last element exists inside of the human soul. No exceptions. So all of the characters that we describe and all of the things that take place between them are all explained as a way in which to make evident a certain potential that exists within ourselves. And all great stories are that way. You know, the classic fairy tales, the classic myths, these stories are all pointing to elements that exist inside of the undiscovered psyche. And the purpose of the story for those to whom it applies is to make evident to these people that there is a relationship that they can see and know is true, even though they may not understand the symbology. And of course, we can't understand the symbology until it becomes a part of our being, which is what the whole of this life is for. So poor David, the Darkly brothers, they're taking up, just tearing the town apart. And what does the sheriff have to do? He's got to go confront the Darkly brothers. Now, what are the Darkly brothers? Have you ever had the Darkly brothers run into your small Western town? You know what I'm talking about. You're sitting there having your coffee in the morning. And by the way, when you hear them coming, what's your usual thing? You know, I'm going to go mix it up with the Darkly brothers. They're not going to push me around. No, sir. And then 2 minutes later, you're laying on your back someplace full of psychological bullet holes born out of resisting a force that was generated by your own mind that you don't know. And then you fight it and only strengthen it. Which is what happens every time one of the darkly fears drives into the psychology of a human being. And we don't want the fear, so we try to escape it by either confronting it, which makes true for us that which we fear, or by running from it, which makes true that which we fear. And neither one of those solutions do anything except cement in this dark psychology, this sleeping psychology. It only makes it seem real to us. And the more that it seems real to us, the more likely we are to either fade or find alternative routes. How many of you know alternative routes to problems? It's called vacationing. It's called drugs. It's called drink. It's called incessant television. It's called never having quiet in the house. You fill in the blanks and you'll see that all of it's born out of an attempt to escape the Darkly brothers, and you don't understand the Darkly brothers. You just don't want them in your town. They are your town, but they don't have to remain that way. So David the sheriff, and this has to happen. This is all part of real education, spiritually speaking. He goes up and he decides to have a nice talk with the Darkly brothers. Have you ever tried to have a nice talk with somebody who just stole something from you? You say, look, you don't understand, sir. You shouldn't shoot at my feet. Bang, 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 bang. And poor David's doing the wild cowboy dance. You've seen it. And they're laughing their heads off because here comes this poor, stupid dude in a cowboy hat. And who is he to monkey with the Darkly brothers? And poor David, he's pretty sure that he's made the mistake of his life. Because there's no way he's going to get rid of the Darkly brothers. And I need to strengthen this a bit now. Human beings become apathetic in life because they have fought and failed to throw out the Darkly brothers so many times. They've looked for ways to build a home on a hill where the Darkly brothers can't get to, and no one escapes the Darkly brothers because they go wherever the unconscious human being goes. And this poor sheriff, he's thinking to himself, I have a new plan. I'm moving. I'm going to move someplace where the Darkly brothers won't be. And that was fine, probably back in like 720 AD, where human beings, when they would see the mess that they had made of the world they were in, just said, hey, let's find a new world. Because we'll start fresh there. It'll be much better. 2,000 years later, or whatever it is, here we are. And let's go to the moon. Mars will work. There's water there we can pollute. No, we won't pollute it. Someone will own it before we get there. Trust me. If it hasn't already happened and you don't know it. But don't get me started. Now, he gets ready to run. And because, unbeknownst to us in this story, but now being exposed, he'd been in other towns where the Darkly brothers had come. Do you remember the High Noon with Gary Cooper? And so at a certain point, and this point has to take place in us, each and every one of us, and you'll understand why. There came a day when the deputy sheriff looked out, and there was David. And he was walking right down the center of the street, and there was the Darkly brothers looking at him coming. It looked like a classic shootout. The deputy sheriff looks out. He thinks to himself, should I help? Well, maybe not. Well, after all, I've got mine. I have to take care of mine. And David starts walking right up the street. And the next thing that the deputy knows is all of a sudden boy, the Darkly brothers, they pull out their six shooters, bang, 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 just lead flying everywhere, lead flying everywhere. And while the deputy is watching with his own two eyes, David walks up to each one of the Darkly brothers, takes them by the corner of the shirt, and walks them across the street into the jail, throws them in the cell, comes back and gets another one, one by one, while they're shooting. Could it be? The deputy says, he walks up to the sheriff, to David, after, I don't know what just happened. He said, the air was full of hot lead. There you were. You just kept walking straight ahead like it wasn't even there. What on earth just happened, David? David says, you know, I'm not sure myself. Something came over me, the likes of which I can't rightly understand. Told you I was going to try to do Western for you. What was that? Oh, no. His name was Roy, not David. See, Roy is a funnier name than David. All right, I'm going to go back and start the whole story over. What was that, Roy? He said, and Roy said, well, the whole time I was walking up to the Darkner brothers, I could hear myself saying the same thing over and over and over again. Now tell me, Roy, what was you saying? I ain't dodging no more bullets. I ain't dodging no more bullets. Who wants to live their life dodging bullets? And in case you think I'm talking about lead, I'm not talking about lead. I'm talking about the moments in life where it's evident that if you do what you've always done before, you're just dodging a bullet. You see, when a man, when a woman decides in favor of what is true, and in this instance, what's true, we could just say decency, kindness, integrity. When an individual decides that it's more important to live those qualities than it is to be part of a nature within themselves that promises those qualities if and when they only succeed at doing X, Y, Z, then something happens that can never be described, because the only way that someone can know it happens is when they step out onto that stone, when they don't dodge the bullet anymore. Now, I made a list for us to study and to use really as an exercise of ways in which we dodge bullets. And if you were really earnest, you would go home tonight and you would make a list for yourself of places where you dodge bullets. Now let's just get right to the brass tacks. How many of you know that you dodge bullets? All right. Here are ways that we dodge bullets. Every time we fawn in front of another human being, we've dodged a bullet. Every time, no exceptions. Now, every time that we bully a human being to get our way, we've dodged a bullet. So don't think that just because you're a demure human being, and how many demure human beings are there, that I must not be dodging bullets. No, to dodge a bullet means that I'm talking to someone, or I need to talk to someone. In fact, I better bring in the next dodge. How many of you know that you need to say something to someone that needs to be said, and you rehearse it for 40 years before you get it out? Don't you see that's dodging a bullet? And by the way, this is the truth. You will see this, and when you see it, you'll understand why you mustn't do it. Every bullet you dodge hits you. It never fails. The avoidance of a fear is living out the fear you're trying to avoid. Just because your mind is telling you you've escaped it, you've done something to the Darkly brothers, doesn't mean that your psychological, emotional, intellectual, physical system isn't being taxed to the max, because it is, compromising us. How about this for dodging a bullet? Going around, just period, going around. How many of you understand the difference between what it means to go around a problem versus going through it? We're masters of going around problems. But we've also seen, if we're honest, that what we go around comes around, doesn't it? We don't really go around it. Somehow the thing knows we went around it, and it's there when we get to the other side. What are you doing here? And if we could hear that intelligence say, you don't understand. Listen, please. You don't understand. I'm here for you. I'm here for you. This moment that you don't want, where you're trying to dodge the bullet, whatever the bullet may be, another example, saying yes to someone when you really want to say no. Don't you understand that? How many of you ever say yes to people when you want to say no? That's dodging a bullet. And the way you know you're dodging a bullet is that you get hit with resentment the second you do it. It's a 44 caliber too, that resentment thing. Another example. I hinted at this earlier. How many of us spend time around other human beings that while we're spending time with them, we wish we weren't spending time with them? Oh boy, this should be a room of very nervous people because you all came with friends. I looked at this woman when that man said yes. She looked at him like, what? Why do we spend time around human beings that vex us? Why do we do that? We're dodging a bullet called loneliness. We're dodging a bullet called the fear of not succeeding. And if I just associate and fawn enough with this person, he or she may put me in a position where I can acquire whatever it is that I believe will make me fearless. We're meant to be like Roy. We're meant to be like Roy, who one day wakes up and realizes that as long as he spends his life dodging bullets, he'll never have command of anything. Because when a person runs from a situation, no matter how he labels it, no matter how she may define it in spiritual terms, you know, that's another thing. In that, I didn't put it in because I ran out of time on that story, but in that world where the bridge was, people talked about that the reason they didn't cross was because the great value of living with uncertainty. I'll give you a minute to think about it. You're out with your spiritual friends and, you know, yes, it's all uncertain. I'll tell you what's certain. It is certain unless you and I as individuals start to understand what it means to no longer dodge bullets that we'll never find out for ourselves. And I wrote down a key lesson. I write down these key lessons. Let me read it to you. We must learn to see the value of practicing fearlessness, but not so that we may obtain powers or possessions that lend us their temporary liberty, but in order to be released from fear altogether. We practice fear. Every time we dodge a bullet, every time we avoid contact, a situation, every time we think to ourselves we can't because this or that may take place, or we revisit what once happened to us and we let it define us, we are actually at that moment as human beings practicing fear. And when you practice fear, you perfect it. Only the rub is it isn't you that's practicing it. It isn't you that's perfecting it. It has to do with an unconscious nature inside of ourselves that first projects the image of what is to be feared so that then it can resist it and say, look, we better avoid this. And all of that tension gives us a very solid sense of ourselves so we can have a drink. Or whatever it is. Some way to avoid it. So, what are we here on earth for? I would say that we're here on earth in order to outgrow, listen, to outgrow our belief in the need of fear altogether. See, we actually, even though we don't see it, we actually believe that we need our fears to protect us. Because when the moment comes and who we take ourselves to be is threatened by something, to whom do we turn? Please, don't push this away. To whom do we turn? I'll ask you. When something happens and a fear presents itself, don't you go into immediate think mode? trying to figure out what to do in order to get rid of the situation that's threatening whatever it is that you say is being threatened? Don't we turn to ourselves in those moments as though somehow the self that fears lives with something that understands the fear and is going to rescue us from it? Well, the Darkly brothers can't rescue you from the Darkly brothers. But understanding that about ourselves, saying, look, you know what? I'm starting to worry about tomorrow. Now, I'm not saying if you have practical business to attend to and you need to do certain things practically with the mind, you do the practical things with the mind. That's what it's for. But to use the mind to try to protect yourself from a situation that the mind has itself imagined into existence can never do anything except keep us the captive of that mind, and never in command of ourselves, but rather commanded by a mind that promises to release us from the very fear it produced. So we must stop dodging bullets. I never give a talk without making it possible for those who wish to leave the very place where we're talking and discover in that moment where it is that they're trying to dodge a bullet. And the first time you don't dodge a bullet is the first step on that seven-step bridge. First time. You know why? Because you find out nothing happened to you the way you thought it would. Then it isn't hypothetical anymore. It isn't an imagined situation where you're hoping that certain things will relieve you from the terror that comes with being a possessor of whatever it is that grants freedom. Then in that moment, you for yourself have done the one thing that I believe we're here to do, which is to place ourselves in relationship with an intelligence that is able to take no matter what the moment is and show us that what we have imagined is true isn't, and that there is a truth that is greater than what we've imagined, that not only relieves us from the false responsibility of trying to save ourselves, but shows us that the self we were trying to save was as illusionary as the fear itself. Then as that grows inside of a human being, that relationship with real life, capital R, capital L, he or she begins to welcome. Want to hear something fantastic? How would you like to live a life where it didn't matter what life threw at you, you were able to take whatever came, and because of your relationship with that which can transform whatever it comes into it, you were able to take and make for it another stepping stone, if you will, meaning another certainty that isn't born in thought, that your life has already been provided for, all the command you need, if you will just step out onto that stone, if you just won't dodge the bullet. The second story was the father saying, I helped your brother because he got started. All you do is talk about getting started. Do you know that it doesn't matter how old we are, it doesn't matter how much water is under the bridge, spiritually speaking, that every single one of us, anytime we want to, we can really actually start for ourselves to discover that fear has no authority. None. It's a ghost. And it isn't until we actually discover for ourselves that fear is nothing, a non-entity. It's indigestion of the mind. It isn't until we see that that we can begin in the moment that it presents itself. When the Darkly brothers ride in, we can walk straight through the hail of those assaults, straight through the hail of our fears, straight through the hail of hell as it wants to turn you away from the bridge. And I promise you that if you'll do the work I've described, you will find it out for yourself, and there is no other way to do it. I test it. I find out if it's true. If I find out it's true, I take the next step. If I don't find out it's true, guess what? See, the bulk of this talk is centered on one essential idea. And the essential idea is that we go around and we say, is this the truth? How do I know this is the truth? And so we create icons, we create spiritual leaders, we create all of this business around us by which we decide for ourselves whether or not he or she knows, or whether or not that's the truth, or this book holds what is can't be challenged. And our lives are all set up with these things outside of ourselves. And all we do is wind up serving them. I'm saying that if we want to know what's true, let us test it. so that I know for myself whether it's true, not because he, she, this or that, or some religion that's 5,000 or 50,000 years old says it's true. I know it's true because I put my foot there and it didn't give way. And I saw the fear didn't have the right over my life that it said it did just to the moment before I took that step. And then I don't need anyone or anything around me to be some kind of leader or motivational expert or whatever it is that people are looking for so they can follow something into a world that the person they're following doesn't know a thing about, or he wouldn't be asking them to follow them. What an opportunity. What an opportunity. Every moment of our lives. Find out. The whole talk is about that. Find out. See for yourself whether or not the things that are literally the establishment of your life, the foundation of the way you interact with each other, find out if one has to serve those things the way we presently serve them, or whether or not by doing that we're dodging a bullet that we never had to dodge, were it not for parts of us that tell us that if we don't do that, we're going to lose something. How can you lose more than your own life? Which we're losing. I invite you to find out.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit, Life of Learning Foundation, visit guyfinley.org. That's GUYFINLEY.org. Receive helpful free gifts along with a host of life-changing information. That's guyfinley.org.